Now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Good morning and welcome to Power of Attorney, a 30-minute educational program focused on legal developments affecting individuals and businesses. Power of Attorney is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, PC, a full-service law firm located in Reston, Virginia, serving clients in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area and across the country. You can learn more about Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman on the web at www.ofplaw.com or by calling us at 703-218-2100. Regular listeners may have expected to hear Blueprint for Wealth in this time slot. Blueprint for Wealth has become Power of Attorney, which will cover a broader range of legal topics and feature rotating hosts depending upon the subject matter being discussed. I'm John Frieden, your host for the next six shows, as we discuss starting, operating, and exiting an internet business. I'm also the author of the e-commerce law blog at www.ecommercelaw.typepad.com, which is a regularly updated discussion of news, trends, and legal issues affecting internet businesses. On today's show, we'll be discussing forming an entity for your new internet business. To ease the transition from Blueprint for Wealth to Power of Attorney, my guest today is Wayne Zell, who hosted Blueprint for Wealth for 7 years and is one of my partners at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman. Wayne focuses his practice on tax, estate, and business planning matters and is uniquely suited to answer our questions about entity formation. Welcome, Wayne.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here in the guest seat for a change.
Yes, I feel like I'm welcoming you to your own show, Wayne.
Well, not anymore.
Wayne, when we talk about starting an internet business, one of the first things that I think people think about is whether or not to form it as an entity or just to start doing a business as a sole proprietorship. Do you have any views on which is preferable?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've spoken about it on the show in the past, and I think a sole proprietorship is nice if it's just you and you're really not doing anything that might subject you or your loved ones or your assets to liability. But if you really want to protect yourself and your family and your assets from liability, then I suggest doing one of two things, either incorporating as a corporation or considering setting up a limited liability company, which is another form of limited liability protection entity.
And in order to, and you mentioned that there's certain things that you have to do to make sure that you get the full benefit of those protections. What are those things that you have to do once you form the entity to make sure that you get that benefit?
I think there's two primary things that I would be cautious of if I'm a business owner, even if it's just me setting up the business. And that would be, number one, following all the formalities that the state statutes require. For example, keeping books and records, having a separate bank account with money in it so that the entity has its own bank account, and books and records in the form of your own accounting records, accounting systems, so that you're actually keeping track of all of the activities of the organization. And in addition to the formalities, which are beyond what I've just described, I think there's something that I would really cautious business owners of, and that is the so-called thin capitalization doctrine. There's a way that creditors try to pierce through your corporate veil by arguing that really the entity is not separate and apart from you personally. And so if it has its own assets, such as, you know, business computers, furniture, fixtures, equipment, and bank accounts with money in it, and you keep it separate and you don't commingle it with your personal assets, then I think you'll be okay in terms of trying to succeed against an attack on you by piercing the corporate veil.
So essentially, I think what I hear you saying is that the key to doing it and a good guideline is to treat it as if it was absolutely a separate entity from you in all respects.
In all respects. Keep it separate. Make it a separate business. operate the activities separately, have separate books and records, you know, so on and so forth. Have it have its own space, even if you can afford it. But the bottom line is keep it separate from you as a person or an individual.
And I know that early on in a business's life span, oftentimes the capitalization is, particularly if you have a one-owner business, a lot of times that person is putting their personal funds into the business to make it go. Mm-hmm. How does one document those loans or purchases of equity in such a way that it doesn't come under suspicion in terms of piercing that corporate veil?
That's a great question. One of the things that I recommend to my clients is that they have what is called permanent capital, meaning that when you put money in the business, don't just lend it to the business and then take it back out when you've earned enough money. Leave some money in the business permanently. And then the next question is, well, how much do I have to leave in there? And it really depends on the size of the business and what you're doing. If you're just a service business and all you're doing is rendering consulting services, it may not be that much money. I don't want to give a specific dollar amount, but it really is, you know, having some substance. And, you know, keeping the assets in the business as permanent capital means that you're subscribing to stock if it's a corporation, or you're receiving what's called a membership interest if it's a limited liability company. On the other side is, well, you know, I want to put some money in, but I want to get the money back out. I don't want to leave it in permanently. So I'm going to lend it to the company. Well, how do you evidence a loan? Well, very simply, just as you would if you were borrowing from a bank or a third party, enter into what's called a promissory note. You sign a note saying that the corporation signs a note, or the limited liability company signs a note to you as the lender, saying, I have borrowed this amount of money from you, oh great owner, oh great lender, and I'm going to pay it back to you. And I'm also going to pay it back to you in some period of time. So you state a maturity date for the loan, and I'm going to pay it back with interest. And the IRS actually requires that you maintain some level of interest according to the applicable federal rates, depending on how long the loan is going to be taken out. So you want to have an adequate stated amount of interest depending on what the loan is. And so that's how I would document it. Also, document it in your board minutes. If you're a corporation, you have a board of directors. You always have to elect a board of directors. So the shareholder elects the board, which may be you, right? And so the board then keeps minutes of the fact that it is agreed or approved of the loan from the shareholder to the company and the note back to the shareholder in whatever the terms are.
And I know from being a litigator, I know that when you have cases involving a claim attempting to pierce the corporate veil, inevitably when there is commingling of funds, the owner of the business claims that it was a loan to the company.
Right.
And so they are scrutinized, and they are almost always assumed to have been simply commingling and not a loan if there's not proper documentation. So that's great advice. So I'm a new internet business owner. I've decided that I'm going to start an entity. I'm going to form an entity, either an LLC or a corporation, to get those protections that we talked about. I've committed myself to maintaining corporate formalities. I've committed myself to documenting my transactions with that corporation. My next question is going to be, I'm going to form. Does it matter which state I form my entity in?
And another good question. I think I get this question a lot from even the earliest startup business owner, just, you know, the consultant who wants to start up his or her own business. And the answer, you know, the first question is, well, where do I set up this business? Well, if you live in Virginia and it's just going to be you operating the business, there's no reason to turn to Delaware to incorporate unless you really envision yourself opening up offices all across the country and having, you know, multiple levels of employees and potentially even shareholders. So setting up the entity where you live is a good piece of advice that I'd like to give to the clients. Also, depending on what kind of entity it is, if it's a corporation or a limited liability company, that'll depend on where you live, what, you know, the statutes say in that particular jurisdiction as to whether or not you choose Maryland or Virginia or DC or Delaware. But if you live in Virginia and you want to set up a limited liability company, use the Virginia Limited Liability Company Act to do so. It's really easy to do so, and it's a lot less expensive. On the other hand, if you're going to have outside investment come into the company, such as angel investors or even friends and family, you may want to consider going into a jurisdiction that's friendly towards corporations, like Delaware, like Nevada. And we've had several of our clients choose that jurisdiction because they are business-friendly states. And so they have statutes as well as case law, you know, as a litigator, John, that those states may be better to set up your business in. So that's sort of the rule of thumb that I use.
And what I've found in some of the litigation that I've handled is that Delaware law actually provides certain rights to minority shareholders, minority owners, that Virginia law, for instance, doesn't apply. So where you would want to set up, if you're taking in investors, those friends and family, for instance, may be determined by whether or not you're going to hold the majority interest and whether or not you want to give those individuals those additional rights.
So I've learned that from painful experience involving litigation with my clients where they've set up Delaware corporations and they brought in a minority investor, and all of a sudden we had to provide them with access to books and records and things that you may not have to do under other state statutes. So yeah, definitely check it out in terms of what you plan on doing. What does your business plan say you're going to be doing in 3 or 4 or 5 years? If you're going to take an outside investment, then you may seriously want to consider the state of incorporation and what rights it affords to minority owners.
And those rights give rise to claims. I mean, the oppression of minority owners in a business is not a claim recognized in Virginia, but it's recognized in Delaware.
Absolutely.
And it's problematic for those majority owners. So I've been convinced as a business owner that I want to start an LLC, for instance, in Virginia. And you've mentioned how easy that is if you just use the Virginia limited liability statute.
Okay.
When should a business owner consider forming the entity himself or turning to one of those services like LegalZoom as opposed to hiring a lawyer to do it?
You know, I really am averse to using those online services only because if you're going to be having anything anybody in the business other than yourself, a child, an employee, even independent contractors, you may have questions about what to put in your articles of incorporation or your articles of organization or your operating agreement or your bylaws or your shareholders agreement, whatever it is. Who are you going to get to answer those questions if you use LegalZoom.com? Now, I've had clients set up on LegalZoom and then come to me to fix it later on, which is fine with me, but I think it ends up costing more in the long run. So I think it's better to, you know, go to an attorney who has experience in setting up companies before you do it.
And after one's decided to go ahead and start the entity, they've hired a lawyer to form the entity, what's the next professional you think that a business owner should consider retaining or consulting?
I think going to a CPA is a good idea. I do.
And in a lot of respects, in terms of evaluation of tax benefits and the like, a CPA actually may have some information that your attorney, even a tax attorney, might not have.
Correct. I agree with that.
So we're going to take a short break now. I'm John Frieden, and you've been listening to Power of Attorney, sponsored by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. To learn more about the firm, please visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com or call us at 703-218-2100.
You're listening to Power of Attorney with the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. Learn more about legal developments affecting individuals and businesses when Power of Attorney returns in a moment. A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
What does an employer have to do before hiring an employee? Besides federal and state laws that prohibit discrimination in the workplace and mandate standards for worker safety, employers have to fulfill several basic requirements before employing workers. They must determine if the worker is an employee or an independent contractor. Issues such as tax withholding from employee paychecks and liability may be implicated by this decision. They should also use federal and state guidelines to determine whether workers are in fact employees. Employers should obtain federal and state employer ID numbers, which are used for tax purposes. Depending on the state, employers may also be required to participate in a workers' compensation insurance pool and obtain an unemployment and compensation identification number. Some states may have additional requirements for employers, so employers may want to consult with an experienced employment law attorney to ensure compliance with federal and state law.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney. I'm John Frieden. With me is my special guest, Wayne Zell. We've been talking about entity formation for new internet businesses, for internet startups. And when we left off, we were talking a little bit about the place of formation of these entities and the benefits of those protections. And I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the popular entity types. We talked in broad terms about limited liability corporations, and we talked about corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the IRS statistics, the two most popular entity types for small businesses are limited liability corporations and something called a C-Corp. What is this? Oh, I'm sorry, an S-Corp. What is an S-Corp, Wayne, if you could?
Well, an S-Corp is a creature of the tax code. It was created back around 1954 originally, and it allows taxpayers to elect to treat a corporation and now a limited liability company as a special hybrid kind of entity. What it does is you can own the property as long as you satisfy certain eligibility criteria and certain continuing criteria. You can own your property in the S-Corp at the corporate level, achieve all the limited liability protection that you would normally have as a corporation. But instead of the corporation having to pay tax on the earnings from the activities in the company through services or the sale of property or inventory, the income flows through to the shareholder. So there's only one level of taxation. And so that's why it's so popular these days, because if you're taxed at the corporate level at today's rate of 35%, and then you're taxed as an individual at rates now up to 43.8%, you've got a pretty significant double taxation burden. So to be able to pass that through at only one level of tax is beneficial.
So both the limited liability corporations and these, the limited liability companies,
yeah,
and these S-Corps,
right,
permit a business owner to avoid that double layer of taxation.
Yeah, the LLC, the limited liability company, is if you have two or more people in the business with you owning the company, it's going to be treated as a partnership for tax purposes. So the partnership rules and the S-Corp rules bear a lot of similarities. They allow you to flow through income. They allow you to flow through losses in some ways in the same way. Partnerships actually are the more flexible of the two vehicles. And so I use partnership taxation a lot more frequently than I do the S-Corp, but the S-Corp does have its advantages. For example, if you've got earnings in an S-Corp and you've got a bunch of people working for you, generating those earnings, and the earnings flow through to the bottom line, meaning that you've paid out all your salaries and all your bonuses that you're going to pay, and now you have some leftover income, the S-Corp allows you to characterize those net earnings as being something other than being subject to self-employment tax. So it won't be subject to self-employment tax, whereas if it were in a partnership setting, all those net earnings are going to be subject to the payroll or self-employment tax. And that's one of the reasons why accountants often advise clients to use the S-Corp setting. But there's some traps for the unwary with an S-Corp. Here's one. Never put real estate in an S-Corp. Why? Because if you put it in, you're not going to be able to get it out without paying tax on the appreciation in the real estate, even though you haven't sold it. And so there are lots of little traps for the unwary with S-Corps that you don't have with partnership taxes, and there are a lot of benefits of partnership taxes that you don't have with S-Corps. The other thing that you have to worry about with S-Corps is this. S-Corps are subject to some very strict eligibility criteria. So, for example, you cannot have someone who is a non-resident alien own shares of an S-Corp or an interest in an LLC that elects to be taxed as an S-Corp. LLCs can elect to be taxed as S-Corps. You cannot have certain trusts own interests in an S-Corp. You can't have foreign corporations or corporations at all own interests in an S-Corp. In fact, you cannot have an LLC that's taxed as a partnership own an interest in an S-Corp. Otherwise, it inadvertently terminates your S election and it's treated as a regular corporation, which could be devastating. So we've run into these issues over our career of 32 years representing clients on these types of issues, and you just have to be careful if you're going to use the S-Corp structure. On the other hand, the LLC is very, very flexible if you treat it like a partnership. The only problem is you better get somebody who's familiar with partnership taxation, because there are so many quirks and issues that come up in the partnership context. I've been talking. Let me let you ask some questions.
Sure. I just want to make sure that it's clear. And we see plenty of people who are very good in business not understanding the intricacies, obviously, of the law, which is why they come to see us.
Right.
What I hear you saying is that for an S-corp, there's some limitations on the types of entities or people who can own ownership interests in those S-corps.
Right. Very, very well stated.
And so what people may not know is that a company can actually be a member, for instance, of an LLC, and so actually own an ownership interest just like a person would. So you could have a two-member LLC where one member is Wayne Zell and one member is, you know, ABC Corporation, for instance, and that would not happen with certain types of entities with an S-corp.
That's exactly right. In fact, a lot of joint ventures that are created between companies these days are structured as limited liability companies because it's such a flexible form of doing business. And it's easy to own that interest. And as long as you treat it as a partnership for tax purposes, then that joint venture structure gives you limited liability protection as well. So LLCs are really, I think in my practice and in our practice in the firm, I'd say they're probably more the choice of entity. Except for government contractors who often gravitate towards the S-corp or an LLC that elects to be taxed as an S-corporation.
Now, I see a fair number of new internet business owners in my office on a fairly regular basis.
Right.
And one of the first things they always talk to me about is their intent to raise capital at some point in the future of the company. In terms of an LLC or an S-corp, are there differences in the availability of capital or how one would raise capital or the ease of raising capital with either of these two entity types?
Yeah, definitely, John. I think the S-corp is a much more difficult structure to raise capital in. If you want to raise money from the outside, from investors, from pension funds, from venture capital funds, from individuals, you're going to find that either the C-corporation or an LLC taxed as a partnership is the way you're going to go. And particularly if you're raising money from venture capital funds or private equity funds, they will insist that you use, number one, a C corporation structure and a Delaware entity or a Nevada entity to raise the money. And so raising capital in an S corporation is much more difficult. And the main reason is that S corporations only allow you to have one class of stock. That class of stock can be non-voting or voting, but it can only be common stock that gives the owners essentially the same rights as all other owners have, other than the voting issues. In a corporation with investors, you can give them preferred stock and a return on their investment. In an LLC taxed as a partnership, you can do the same thing. You can have different classes of equity. And so it's a lot more flexible either to use an LLC like a partnership or a C corporation.
And we talked a little bit about tax issues before and income tax and employment taxes you mentioned. Now, there's a difference in how write-offs are handled, I believe, between the S-corps and the LLCs. Could you explain a little bit about that to our listeners?
Yeah, there's a myriad series of tax provisions, starting with the basis rules, and we have the so-called at-risk rules, and then we have the passive loss rules all layered on top of each other, which make it more and more difficult to claim losses from a business entity. But the basis rules are one of the fundamental ways in which S-corps differ from LLCs taxed as partnerships. And what I mean by that is if in a partnership, you borrow money at the partnership level, or you lend money to the partnership, either on a recourse or a non-recourse basis, you will get basis in your partnership interest, and that will increase your ability to claim losses. In an S corporation, by contrast, it's a lot harder to get tax basis in your stock interest. There are certain requirements that you have to meet. And one of those requirements is, for example, if you just lend money to the entity, you may not be entitled to claim basis in your stock interest unless you satisfy certain criteria. Or if you guarantee a loan that's made to the corporation, normally you would think, well, hey, I'm at risk for all of this, so I should have to be able to deduct my losses. But guarantees of corporate loans in an S-corp setting do not give you tax basis, whereas in a partnership setting, it will, and you may be able to claim the losses. So be very careful if you think that you're going to have startup losses, particularly in an internet startup company, which I've dealt with having worked for one for a while, and we had substantial losses. I can tell you that you've got to be careful about the choice of entity in that context.
Okay, when we're getting towards the end of our time, I'd like to do a speed round. Three or four questions, very quick, and getting your advice on. So if I was to come to your office and ask you, generally speaking, if I was a one-person operation with no outside investment, what entity type would you recommend forming and where?
I would set up an LLC, And I may consider, instead of being taxed as a sole proprietorship, I may consider having you make an S-Corp election so that the LLC files a separate tax return on Form 1120S, and you still get the flow through of your earnings, but you may be able to shelter some additional deductions at the corporate level that you might not have been able to at the individual level.
So, different question. Let's say I'm a 2 or 3 person operation, friends from college, you know, computer science students who got together to create an internet business, no outside investment. What would you recommend for us?
I'd start off with the LLC again, the limited liability company, and I would consider using the partnership structure initially just to give you flexibility in case you have losses at the startup phase. Then, after you're going along for a little while, look at the growth pattern of the company and figure out what your business plan is. If you're going to be bringing in a lot of owners into the company and diluting the ownership among many, many different people, you may want to consider either staying partnership or converting to a corporation at some point in time.
Third one, I'm a person or a group, and I'm coming into you. There's going to be a core group that's actually doing the work, but we're going to have a couple silent partners who are investing a lot of the money. Mm-hmm. Our equity is based on sweat equity. What would you recommend for us, Ryan?
Wow. That could go two different ways. In one direction, from the investor's perspective, they may say to you, well, you know, I want to protect my investment. And in protecting my investment, I want to have a priority over you as a sweat equity owner. So you may get common stock for your ownership. But me as the investor, I want preferred stock so that if the company does get liquidated, I get my money back before you do. So if we're going to use preferred stock and common stock, then we're going to do one of two things. We're going to set up a regular corporation, probably in Delaware, or we may use a limited liability company but tax it as a partnership. That's not quite as flexible from the investor's perspective because certain tax-exempt investors don't like limited liability companies taxed like partnerships. On the other hand, if we can convince everybody to own the same kind of equity, then maybe an S corporation will work. And an S corporation or an LLC that elects to be taxed as an S corp. It all depends.
And we've talked a lot about LLCs and S corps. Very quickly, are there instances where a C corp may be the better choice?
Yeah, I've gone the C corp route, where I've got outside investment anticipated, maybe multiple rounds of investment, particularly in an internet startup company that might have a good technology or a good product that we're developing. And so the C corp is really conducive to inviting multiple rounds of investment with preferred stock of different series or classes. And so I've used that almost exclusively for that type of structure, particularly where we're dealing with technology or outside investment that is going to take a long time to get the product to market and get it distributed.
Wayne, thank you so much for being with us today. If our listeners have any other questions about any of these issues, the tax implications or entity formation, how can they contact you?
Well, thanks, John. Send me an email to wayne.zell@ofplaw.com or call me at 703-218-2177.
And if you're interested in these issues or any other related issues or have questions about starting, operating, or exiting an internet company, please visit eCommerce Law on the web at www.ecommercelaw.typepad.com, or you can follow me, Jonathan Friedan, on Twitter at Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Friedan, F-R-I-E-D-E-N, or you can email me at jonathan.friedan@ofplaw.com. Thank you for listening. Please make Power of Attorney a regular part of your Saturday morning. For the next 5 weeks, we'll continue discussing how to start, operate, and exit an internet business. Our guests this month will include a number of internet business owners, ranging from individuals just starting out to serial entrepreneurs who have started, built, and sold multiple internet businesses. Have a great week. We look forward to talking to you next week.
You've been listening to Power of Attorney with Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Power of Attorney will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500 a.m. and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.